Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I discuss the all-too-familiar feeling of shame. We define shame and contrast it with guilt, identify potential sources of internalized shame and narratives. We reveal how to create awareness around and edit those self-limiting narratives. We'll explore how authentic expression and self-acceptance allows us to realize our full potential, and much, much more. A couple of announcements for you before we get into the episode. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. It's been really, really rewarding for myself as an instructor in a lot of those training courses to see some of you podcast listeners taking the course. It's been great to connect with you there. You hear Reed and I talk a lot about psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does here on the podcast. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. And of course, if you'd like to support this show, you can do so by leaving us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify, especially if you'd like to take the time to leave us a written review, especially if you like us. Reed and I read those reviews and are deeply moved by the ways in which this show has affected your lives for the better. Without further ado, here is an episode on shame. Reed, I have a suspicion. My suspicion is that nearly every person who's listening to this podcast episode has had the experience of shame. Whether they have been shamed or whether they have shamed or are shaming themselves, I imagine it's a fairly universal experience. What say you, Reed Robison?
I second that suspicion. Yeah, it's, what were we just talking about earlier, that it's one of those primal emotions? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems primal, seems fundamental to who we are, that which kind of begs questions about why. You know, if you believe in evolutionary psychology, you think that perhaps the forces of evolution selected for such a thing. Could shame have some kind of evolutionary function to it, do you think?
Well, if you ask the textbooks, they say that shame evolved to sustain close connection with your tribe, your other humans. Mm-hmm. And it can go awry, obviously, when you put an overemphasis on that and internalize it. We'll talk about this.
Yeah.
But take it into ways that are maladaptive, but you can kind of, it's one of the harder things potentially to trace its evolutionary roots, but that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, when you were telling me what you read about in that textbook, that perhaps it has some relationship to the feeling of disgust, which is another primary emotion that perhaps evolved to help us avoid things that would have poisoned us or harmed us.
Yeah.
So if you look at that through a social lens, if you do something that is not pro-social in your small group and that results in you being ejected from that group, you could literally die. And so perhaps shame was a feeling that was adaptive in that way. Like, oh, I've been shamed by my group for stealing food or for being selfish. So that emotion perhaps motivates me not to do that so I can stay a member of the group.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, this is just a little random tangent coming out of my brain, but, shame drives you to hide or deny that wrongdoings happened. Mm-hmm. And in that evolutionary lens, that could be in theory for your survival, at least short-term survival,
yeah,
not get booted. But then we'll make the distinction here that guilt drives you more to make amends. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm, shame in our oversimplified model, shame bad, guilt good.
Right.
We'll clarify, but evolution doesn't care about our semantics.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe they're two sides of a many-sided die or something like that, but they're definitely related. Often when people make the distinction between shame and guilt, they might say something like, shame is I am bad And then guilt is, I have done something bad. Yeah. So it's less about your identity with the action. And so you can imagine if you're bad, you believe there you have a fundamental flaw, that something's wrong with you deep down inside, which causes you to want to hide it. And it tends to grow in the darkness like a fungus. But if you've done something bad, you want to correct the negative repercussions of that action. And it doesn't mean that you're a bad person.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like that. That's a really useful distinction for everyday life and in therapy.
Right. But,
and it reminds me of what Brené Brown says about it, or, well, two Brené Brown nuggets of wisdom that I like on this topic. One, she says it's helpful to remember that when perfectionism is driving, shame is riding shotgun, and fear is that annoying backseat driver.
Mm.
Pretty cool analogy, Brené. Nice one. But this one's kind of funny. She says, if the only two tools you have in your tool bag are shame or coddle, that's a sorry ass tool bag. Brené,
are you shaming my tool bag, Brené?
Yep.
How dare you? So yeah. She said, if shame and coddling?
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I guess to answer your question of if she's shaming your tool bag, you have to read on, because then she gives her rules, which one of them is build shame resilience.
Resilience. So, yeah, and we could talk, we'll probably get into it a little bit later, what how to address these issues of shame, toxic shame, internalized shame, and how to build shame resilience. But, I think whether or not it has evolutionary roots and is functional in some way, I think the way we distinguish it from guilt is helpful, like you said, in therapy. So moving forward, when we are making reference to shame, we're talking about the toxic kind. We're talking about the kind that is where you get your identity wrapped around badness. And so you're looking at yourself and all your social interactions and your goals and your purpose through this, you know, these crap colored glasses that are smudged with shame.
Yeah. And shame, an internalized sense of shame is associated with so many mental health struggles, right? Mm-hmm. It's what you'd call transdiagnostic, or shows up, in everything from depression, PTSD, of course, understandably, through many others, including like ADHD.
Yeah, addiction, eating disorders, OCD. I mean, it's hard to find a diagnostic label that doesn't have some kind of shame related to it. Even some forms of narcissism, right? Clinical narcissism, narcissistic personality disorder. There's this notion of the fragile narcissists at the heart or at the base of their supposed unapologetic self-confidence is this worry that they're actually not worthy of it.
Yeah. Narcissism is a really interesting one because, if you were to, like the root word in some ways of deconstructing, it could mean like calloused. And so if you see someone who displays narcissistic personality traits, or someone who's a narcissist, if you see them as calloused because they were deeply wounded, it gives you a new sense of understanding and potentially compassion for, you know, them being deeply wounded and having this maladaptive way of showing up that's pushing people away. So I've done this in group trainings with therapists and like in psychedelic therapy trainings as well, of like an exercise of replacing the word narcissism, like that guy is so narcissistic, replace it with something like that guy is so deeply wounded, and see just how it impacts your ability to, you know, have some understanding and navigate that interaction, perhaps with a bigger picture view.
Yeah. Makes me think of that sort of trendy phrase that hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
And so when you can look at the motive as a wound, it does, like you said, it engenders a little bit of compassion.
Yeah. Yeah. Such an interesting topic, shame is.
Yeah, I certainly have experienced plenty of shame in my own life. I can't say that I've been shamed a ton. I mean, it's hard to make it through elementary school without experiencing some shame coming at you from other people. Just thinking about the sources or the roots of shame in our lives, certainly in interacting with other people, if you've ever been bullied or teased or criticized, whether it's coming from a peer or a parent or a teacher or a clergy person, it especially when you're young and you're on sort of squishy footing, you haven't figured out who you are yet, you don't feel particularly competent in any particular area, then to be criticized or shamed, it seeps into the cement at the foundation. And so as you layer on, you know, all the different layers of adult personality through development, this is still in that foundation, and it can cause weakness.
Mm-hmm. And because there's a fine line between that, how we're defining here, shame, like I am bad, versus guilt, I've mm-hmm. done something bad. They're both in theory change agents, right? Mm-hmm. But what we don't want for ourselves and others is to internalize that sense of I am bad. But you do want things to drive positive change. So like some might say, you can't shame yourself into change. You have to love the shadow into light, love yourself into evolution. But shame can drive change. It just comes with a cost.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's about, I think, and I'm just making this up out loud here, is like, your narrative about it, like when someone criticizes you, do you receive it as an attack on your worth as a human mm-hmm. versus, oh, they're pointing out something that needs improvement that I did.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what are the things that affect the development of that narrative style, right? If we go back to childhood, we all come into the world with a kind of, you know, a certain set of what we might call a temperament, you know, how reactive or non-reactive we are to certain emotional states. So like how emotionally aroused we get, but then how we react to those emotions. Are we avoidant of those emotions? So, you know, lots of things mm-hmm. can make us more vulnerable or less vulnerable to internalizing criticism, whether or not it was meant to shame us. So, you know, you can imagine some variation there on mm-hmm. whether or not people will develop an internalized narrative of, whether or not people develop a narrative that results in internalizing criticism as shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're bringing up an important point of the avoidance of negative emotion being tied to the development of shame, mm-hmm. like especially if at risk, developmentally primed for that, or having a narrative that's negative around one's self-worth. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we've said it on here a million times, you've got to feel it to heal it. Emotions mm-hmm. rise and fall. You've got to, the only way out is through, all these sayings that kind of get at that. But I heard this analogy or metaphor recently that I think I thought it was pretty cool. So, it's by, who was it? David Kessler. He was talking about grief, but I think the same applies to a lot of these, difficult negative emotions. And he was talking about how when buffalo see a storm coming, they head toward it. Hmm. They go for it. And because they'll be in the storm for less time, it'll be over faster. But we humans tend to run from our storms, external mm-hmm. and internal emotional storms. And therefore, we end up stuck in that longer.
Hmm. Yeah. I like that analogy. And so to sort of dovetail the narrative into something like that, the story you tell yourself about why, this is a little oblique to what you're saying, but related, about why you either run to or away from that storm can have a lot to do with whether or not you experience shame as a result.
Yeah.
Like how you interpret your own behavior. And some of that interpretation, some of that narrative, again, is influenced by the messages you got about your worth early on in life, whether it was from a parent or a teacher or whatever, like I said before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can imagine making a mistake and then thinking, oh, I am dumb,
or yeah,
I screwed it up, as opposed to that sort of guilty reaction, like, I did something wrong, I can repair that. And you can just imagine how damning that is, how it stops you in your tracks, and it wouldn't really inspire you to head into any storms in the future, right? It would probably tempt you to keep avoiding, like, I can't handle this, I need to seek safety.
Yeah, your suspicion earlier about everyone feeling shame, it's interesting to think about that inner dialogue as well. I would suspect that everyone at some point in their life has said something like that, and attacked their own character in their mm-hmm. inner dialogue, like, I'm such a screw up. Mm-hmm. You know, I've certainly, like, even though I know cognitively the pitfalls of that, I can think of times where I've experienced that in my own head, and I'll be like, whoa, what's going on in there?
Yeah. Yeah. And when, you know, when we work with clients around this, we'll often frame that as a part in their mind, right? Like, where did this voice come from? Where did this inner critic or this judge? I had an adolescent client who called it the judgment fairy one time. Where did it come from, right? Is it really me? Did I inherit it? Is it generational? Is it my mom's voice? Is it my dad's voice? Is it my pastor's voice or whatever? Is it God's voice, right? Do I have this belief that God is a punitive and judgmental God?
The God part.
Yes, the God part.
Yeah. But our parts, like you're saying, especially the protector parts, can develop to protect us, to try and prevent us from feeling shame and, you know, show up with guns out to try and keep anything at bay, because, you know, other parts of us, wounded parts, don't want to feel that.
So you were saying, a second ago, something about the relationship to the narrative. And it reminded me of, you know, a lot of the clients that I work with, especially the hard chargers who are really dissatisfied with what they've accomplished in the life, even though from the outside looking in, it looks like they've accomplished a whole lot. When we start to bring this into the light of awareness and challenge it a bit, they resist because it's like, well, if I don't treat myself this way, then where does my motivation come from? I may have used this metaphor on the podcast before, but I use it with my clients a lot. And this is the idea of clean fuel versus dirty fuel. Mm-hmm. You've heard me say this before.
But, yeah, I like it.
You know, it's if shame is a fuel source, it's still burns hot and it can get you far, but you know, it's coal. There's a lot of collateral damage, a lot of pollution. But if you could switch to nuclear, right? If you can switch to love.
Biodiesel, or, electricity, sure. Maybe?
Yeah, maybe. Let's say solar.
The leftover fat from like the Chinese restaurant that you can repurpose.
And yeah, canola oil or something. Yeah. The point being that, you know, a lot of these people assume they will lose their edge if they give up their inner critic. And what I find is, as we heal some of those wounds and change the narrative, is that their nervous system relaxes when they can be kinder to themselves and they don't lose their edge. If anything, the edge gets honed sharper.
Like if you're a major league baseball player and you're getting up to bat and your inner dialogue is just like, oh, you're such a screw up. Don't screw it up. Don't screw it up. You did last time.
Yeah.
Like that is energy in the wrong direction of the other way of showing up, of like cheering yourself on, right?
And you can still bring discipline and structure to your goals. You can still hold yourself accountable, but it's kind of that so-called like masculine, like divine or enlightened masculine energy and love and structure where there's still accountability, right? There's still discipline, there's still expectations. But it doesn't revolve around you being bad if you don't follow through.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I know I said I wouldn't bring up this overcomplicating factor, which I still won't, but but guilt is interesting because it's, you can have excessive guilt. Like we talk about parental guilt, religious guilt, and you know, if you do get into the semantics, you know, it does become one of those things where, you know, a certain amount can fuel your change in maybe a clean way, but too much can be crippling, even if it doesn't meet that definition for like an internalized shame that makes you want to hide or deny something exists or and is even more maladaptive than excessive guilt that's weighing on you heavily.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm trying to think about guilt versus shame and where the line might be drawn between healthy adaptive guilt or excessive maladaptive guilt.
Yeah.
You know, cause we talk about guilt being in comparison to shame, primarily healthier, but when it is excessive, you promised you wouldn't complicate this, but now my brain's exploding.
Oops. Yeah. But there are some ways of teasing it out. Like if you, every time you break a rule, if you reactively get guilty, because some rules, what do they say, are meant to be broken or, you know, if it's an unrealistic, unreasonable thing, maybe you should be able to, oh, I just should on us. Maybe it would be beneficial to be able to not feel that excessively, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think maybe a good litmus test is, how does this make me feel about myself, and what does it make me want to do?
So, yes. Yeah.
Right. If it makes me feel like I am unable to improve, if it leads to shame, I can't help myself. If it leads to shame, probably not super helpful. Does it make me want to, like you mentioned earlier, make amends?
Improve or punish yourself, yeah, essentially. There you go. Like, that might be a good distinction if we have to settle on one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like it. We're figuring it all out as we go.
Aren't we all? And we will not shame ourselves for not having a perfect knowledge of things.
Yeah. But interesting. Okay. This is another thing I probably shouldn't bring up, but I just want to, is like, is shame. I've read, shows up as early as like 15 months of age, mm-hmm. You know, how to measure, another,
all those baby surveys.
Yeah. Another, question, interesting question. Whereas, like guilt, you know, maybe I'm just pulling them from different sources, but guilt showing up like 3 years of age, for example, I don't have a good answer for that. So I'm just punting it your way.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
let's forget I said
filter
that.
Filter it through early childhood development. Maybe it's relative to a developmental stage and theory of mind and sort of, but it's not uncommon for kids to, when they look like, you know, you look at the research on divorce and you have young children, when their parents split up, regardless of the reason for that split, will often blame themselves, right? Because developmentally, they sort of view the world, what's the right term? Well, just through a lens of me, right? They have a hard time with imagining that the things that are happening in their world had nothing to do with them. It's part of that theory of mind concept.
Yeah, and they're especially prone to it if their parents in visible ways with their words or otherwise were really prone to model shaming oneself or criticizing one's own, you know, person rather than behavior.
I'm glad you brought up the modeling, because we, you know, I mentioned receiving criticism, right? Shame directed at the person. But, you know, you could have had parents who just treated you like an angel, but if they were self-shaming a lot, if you saw a lot of self-criticism, then perhaps you adopt that style just by watching.
Yeah. We do spend tens of thousands of hours in the bosom of the family as we're developing, which is quite formative, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Kids are watching. They watch how you talk about your body. They watch how you talk about your accomplishments. They watch how you talk about your character. They watch how you treat other people. So not to make all you parents paranoid, your children, let me try to put you at ease. This might not work, but your children will not escape you unscathed. It's impossible.
No one.
You're not perfect. It's mm-hmm. okay. You do your best. And sometimes my wife and I will joke around, like, I wonder what our kids are going to talk about us in therapy. Like, how are we going to screw up?
That's a fun question. Yeah. I've wondered that plenty.
But it actually kind of guides some of our parenting strategies, because there's a few things we absolutely do not want them to have to talk to their therapist about. And that's like, dad was never around, or dad was excessively critical, or
he shamed me on the daily.
Yeah. Didn't understand me. Right. Wanted me to be just like him and not like me. You know, just some of these things that you see in movies when kids are yelling at their parents or complaining to their therapists.
It's a big risk in childhood of, you know, we want our parents' attention and approval. Mm-hmm. Right. We were talking about attention as a currency of love last time mm-hmm. we spoke, right, on this podcast. And so you have this setup where you're totally attached to your parent. You want their attention and approval. And, you know, we're not taught as we grow up, at least typically in society, how to navigate these things. Mm-hmm. So it's very common for these disappointments and unmet expectations to be, you know, found in child rearing and passed on through the generations.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, other potential sources of sort of internalizing a shame narrative. We've talked several times about the forces of social media or media in general, right? So if your social media feed is filled with, pictures of people on their vacations or demonstrating their wealth or their morning routine that seems just ridiculous.
And their body.
Their bodies, right? Yeah,
body shaming, fat shaming, food shaming, sleep shaming.
Yeah. It gives you this idea that you're just not doing it right. And maybe that's motivating for some. You know, I've felt inspired by some of the people I follow. But inspiration is a lot different than, holy crap, I can't look like them. I can't be like them. I can't make what they make. I can't feel like them. You know, sometimes even because, you know, you're in this mental wellness space, you get these mental health or mental wellness influencers, quote unquote. And sometimes they give the impression that, if you just do these things, if you just wake up and stare at the sun because Huberman told you to, and do your cold plunge and do your gratitude journal and your reverie and meditate, then all should be well. And you're sitting here thinking, well, I do some of that stuff and all's not well with me. What's wrong with me?
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about all the, like the self-help advice and books and things out there is, for many people and in many circumstances, it's harder to face your big fears, go through those portals of very uncomfortable, unfelt feelings and negative emotions without the presence of a supportive other there, like your therapist or coach or loved one who can support, can help hold this kind of thing. Because, we know that shame grows in the dark, but shame also dies when, like, these old stories we have are told in a loving container.
Yeah. I feel like more and more that's why you and I even have a job sometimes, is that for a person to come in, well, let's say they don't have that kind of support in their regular social lives, and they're talking to someone who's paying attention to them and regards them.
Who doesn't judge reflexively or...
And validates them. And they can tell us things that they maybe wouldn't tell anybody else. And we can say, wow, that must be really hard for you.
Yeah.
You know, that's an incredible feeling. I mean, it's an incredible feeling to say that to somebody. I like that part of my job. It's also an incredible feeling to have that said to me. I've seen my fair share of therapists and coaches and been on the receiving end of that kind of positive regard. And it's magical.
Yeah. You just revealed how simple our jobs are.
It is pretty easy.
The recipe.
I only went to school for 9 years to be able to say, oh, that must be really hard for you. No, it's more complicated than that, but
it is magic.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and Brené Brown, who we referenced earlier, talks about that as being one of sort of the antidotes to this toxicity of shame. And it's being in connection with others, especially with others who have the capacity to sort of meet you where you are and love you and forgive you and give you the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. And that stance of vulnerability that she promotes so much is kind of what we're talking about, of not seeing yourself as bad, but taking on criticism for your growth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what else comes from shame? This is according to Benjamin Franklin, but I agree.
The great psychologist.
Yeah, he said, whatever is begun in anger ends in shame. Hmm. And, you know, while I don't necessarily believe that to be universally true, there are so many instances where people have an internalized narrative around anger being bad or wrong or not something they could or should display. And so as soon as it spills out, because anger is also a primary emotion and can be very healthy and empowering, right? But if you start to squash your shame or start to squash your anger with shame, and then you've got this unfelt anger and the secondary emotion of shame piled on top of it, because you thought you were bad for getting angry in the first place.
Yeah. You know, I think what you're describing is an example of what internalized toxic shame looks like on the outside. You know, you see a lot of people who will blow up in anger, and maybe I would reverse, just sort of flip old Benjamin's saying upside down, and that a lot of time what starts with shame ends in anger. So, you know, something I've experienced this, maybe I do something, something that's really important to me that I feel insecure about, let's say, you know, being a parent. And I'm really trying hard and I fail in some, you know, spectacular way. This is true of a lot of men. It's true of everybody, but I noticed a lot of my male clients that instantly I would go to anger instead.
Yeah.
And so anger becomes the secondary emotion in that case. But, you know, it's my reaction to my embarrassment, to my shame, to my humiliation is just to get pissed.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is that anger can be the cause of shame, the consequence of shame, and it can also be the cure of shame. Because in the bucket of like healthy, empowered anger versus reactive, maladaptive anger, your anger can transform shame, like by holding your ground,
setting a boundary.
Yeah. But I think it's a big deal, this relation between anger and shame. And because when people feel defective, inadequate, they get angry to protect themselves and then might feel ashamed, like we're saying, by feeling angry. And then that there's this shame rage cycle.
Yeah.
Vicious one.
Vicious cycle, or some people like to say a vicious circle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's making me think of other sort of feedback loops. A lot of times people, we could talk a little bit about nice guy or nice gal syndrome and people pleasers who often harbor a lot of anger inside, a lot of resentment. Mm-hmm. They may act passive aggressively because they have this covert contract. We've used this phrase on the show before, that if I am nice to people, then they will, you know, there'll be reciprocity. They'll be as nice to me as I am to them. If I'm always anticipating their needs, they'll anticipate mine. Mm-hmm. And when it doesn't happen, because you've just trained other people to expect everything from you with nothing in return, you get angry and you can withdraw, or you can get kind of shitty. You can get, you know, like I said, passive aggressive.
Resentful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. You can be, yeah. And then it continues, embarrassed about being angry, and that further inhibits your future displays of healthy, empowered anger.
Yeah. And like you said earlier, it's a sort of protection against vulnerability as well. Mm-hmm. And Brené talks a lot about vulnerability. And when I discuss the utility of vulnerability with my clients, for a lot of them, especially if they are trauma survivors, it seems kind of ridiculous. Like,
be vulnerable.
Why would I want to be vulnerable? Like, I'm trying really hard not to be vulnerable. I don't want to get hurt.
I've found that too. You got to circumvent that.
Be judiciously vulnerable. Cause a lot of times what they assume we're saying and what we're not saying is that, I just need to expose my heart to everybody and everything. And if I do that, I'm bound to get hurt by some bad actors. So, in a scenario where you've totally closed off your heart, we need to start, you know, adding some nuance to that equation where, all right, who in my life feels safest to open up a little bit to? And often that starts in the therapy room where there's all that structure to protect them. But
yeah, I have an example from this morning, in fact.
Oh, fresh off the press.
Yeah, because, you know, we as humans, especially males in this society, have been culturally conditioned to not display certain emotions, right? Like tears and whatnot. And there are unique challenges for each gender and shared across, you know, across everyone. But, so, you know, I notice these reflexes sometimes, like trying to squash tears as they come up. And sometimes that can be useful. Like, I think we've talked about when you're holding space for someone, it could be really productive to shed a tear, but not to fall apart wailing, dysregulated, while holding someone's, say, trauma that they're sharing, just as an example. But back to my story is I was, at home this morning and, my youngest daughter came over with flowers and this like mushroom lamp that was just the cutest thing. And I felt like a lump in my throat, like choking up. But I also felt myself reflexively trying to squash those. And so the interaction proceeded and it was just like lovely and touching, but I didn't shed tears. But what I did to try and be, I like authentic, open, if vulnerable is like a hard word to try on, but I just, when I was sending her a thank you message, I just told her it made me choke up.
I like that. If vulnerable is too frightening, start with authentic.
Yeah.
And so that was authentic for you, right? And you confessed that that it made you choke up, and
yeah,
that's a way of letting her in, right? Letting her really see you.
Because that is one of the things about vulnerability or authenticity or like shared humanity, if you will, is like it brings us together like nothing else. Yeah. Like to feel into another's heart. Yeah.
Well, if you want safety in a relationship, there needs to be trust. And if you want trust in a relationship, there needs to be intimacy. And if you want intimacy in a relationship, there needs to be vulnerability. So mm-hmm. you got to back the truck up all the way to vulnerability. And so it's frightening, yes, especially if you've made yourself vulnerable, if you've tried to be intimate and you've tried to trust and it wasn't safe. So we honor all those protectors that have come online to keep you safe. And start with something that is challenging, but not so threatening that it sends your nervous system into fight or flight.
Yeah. So, well said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Telling your daughter, thanks, that made me choke up is a great example. You know, my own sort of resistance to tears is a familiar friend. It happens a lot in movies for whatever reason. Like I'll be watching a movie and there's some scene that just, you know, everyone's sort of watching sort of disinterestedly. And for whatever reason, it plucks a heartstring. And all of a sudden,
Steve's wailing. Yeah. Everyone's distracted.
Like,
and
oh, why is dad
they
crying?
They kick him out again.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and in my, in the interest of not shaming myself, I'll be self-disclosing. Sometimes the emotion that I would use to stop myself from crying was shame, like, or it was anger. It's just like, you know, stop that.
Get it together.
Get it together, man. Pull yourself together.
Yeah.
It's been really nice to not do that sometimes and just sort of let myself cry. And then, you know, my wife looks over and, oh, look how sensitive my big bald man's being. And then, yeah, that's, I get brownie points for, for being sensitive.
Vulnerability works.
Pays off.
And you know, the evolutionary underpinnings of shame we were talking about, further evidence for that comes from the fact that in some societies that are more conformist, I guess technically they call it collectivist. Mm-hmm. There's more of a risk for shame. Mm-hmm. Or more prevalence of shame versus societies that are just more individualistic.
Right.
Yeah.
So cultural factors are important to give a nod to. It's not all an inside job.
Yeah. Like we were talking about our culture, like North American societal norms and how emotions have traditionally been feared and avoided. But if you look at other places, like one example from this thing I'm talking about is Japan has what you might call shame-disdain norms, meaning anger is avoided, disdain is used to socialize, which leads to shame.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I remember when I was a young graduate student therapist working in a college counseling center, I had a client, female student from Japan, and she wouldn't look me in the eye the entire session. And I was just assuming, oh, she's very depressed and really embarrassed and ashamed. I remember telling my supervisor that. He's like, yeah, maybe. Or maybe she's just from Japan. And you're a man.
And you're not.
Yeah. And she has, you know, certain, and I'm sure this is not true of all Japanese individuals and the entire culture, but for the place where she came from and the family structure that she came from, it was considered impolite to stare me down, to, you know, look me in the eyes. Mm-hmm. She also happened to be depressed, which is why she was in counseling, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those cultural forces are potent and real.
And, one other thing comes to mind is, kind of an oxymoron of sorts is, having an experience of shame inside of you can lead you to seek out therapy, but then seeking out therapy can bring about in some people more so in the past, hopefully the stigma is reducing, but can bring more shame of people feeling, oh no, I need to go to therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of back to that narrative, right? That if I have to go to therapy, then something must be wrong with me. I couldn't pull myself up by my bootstraps. I couldn't do it on my own. I've got a fundamental flaw and I need help from some shrink to make me feel better.
Well, everyone, let's just normalize going to therapy as being awesome. Yeah. And I think that's happening, to be honest.
I think so too.
At least in the younger generations, embracing it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like all of my kids' friends are in therapy. And you know, I say that a little tongue in cheek, but also like you're saying, I think it's great. I mean, some people will say everyone should go to therapy. I don't know about that, but I think it's certainly helpful that everyone should feel liberated and free enough to seek help if they need it.
Yeah, I like that.
So other things that manifest as a result of internalized toxic shame, avoiding conflict is another one. We talked about avoiding just unpleasant emotions, but more along the line of that people pleaser, nice guy, gal archetype. It's not uncommon for somebody who just has this internalized shame to just avoid any kind of conflict that could result in them being found out that they're bad, or that can result in rejection because they're so sensitive to rejection, because a lot of their locus of control or source of worth is externalized. So, you know, if you need reassurance from other people to, and it's like trying to fill a bucket with holes, or as my dad would say, a sieve. He would say your brain's like a sieve, which is like an old person way of shaming you for being dumb. But you can't fill that bucket up quick enough. So you plug the holes internally, and not a bad thing to want reassurance from other people. But if that's your only fuel source, then you're going to run dry pretty quick.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So a couple of things on my mind about more things, I guess, about healing from shame. I don't do them as much now, but I used to do a lot of group therapy, and we talked about the benefits of, you know, being an individual therapy and how healing that can be to be validated and seen and held and loved and regarded. But it's a different kind of thing to have that done by your peers. And, you know, I would see this, especially in groups that I ran with military folks with PTSD, a lot of shame wrapped around, you know, especially whether, the things that they might've done in battle. And really nobody but their fellow service members could relate to them on a level that they would accept. And so, sure, it was nice to hear validation from me, but to hear it and receive it from their peers was super potent. So again, back to this idea that, shame thrives in secrecy and in the dark, when we can be vulnerable and open up and find that not only do other people not reject us or run away from us, but they've had similar experiences. That they have felt similar ways. It's incredibly comforting. Right? Yeah. You're not alone.
Yeah. I've seen that play out in kind of mind blowingly powerful ways over and over again in group therapy. Mm-hmm. In working even with like couples, families, but in the PTSD example's a good one, especially combat related PTSD, because you can have an overgeneralized kind of facade of anger, understandably, as a protective suit against, in response to your trauma, that can keep a lot of things at bay and make you really trigger happy with your anger and reactive to any little thing until one finds a way into or toward more vulnerable place.
Right.
Yeah. And which can happen in groups.
Yeah. Yeah. And the shame source for those folks might not be what the layperson thinks. Like I had a lot of clients who, only had one leg blown off instead of all their limbs, or, you know, they didn't die, or they only had a TBI.
Survivor's guilt.
They were survivors.
Turned into shame. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They compare themselves to others. You know, I remember I had a client who had seen just the most horrific things that you can see. I mean, just imagine them in a battle scenario, and was experiencing a lot of, you know, PTSD symptoms as a result, but also a lot of shame for experiencing those symptoms because his wound was quote unquote invisible. And, you know, he didn't deserve his suffering because he wasn't one of the ones that got physically injured.
That's the hard part about, having a mental health struggle is that is often an invisible wound is if you have a cast you're wearing around out there, people will offer you sympathy. But, you know, whether it's displayed or not, if it's not displayed, if you're not showing it, how can they? And societally, some things that you're showing, like we talked about narcissism, et cetera, might not be accepted, or there might not be a compassionate response to those things that are still a painful struggle for the individual.
Right. Right. So addressing shame in community with people that you can be vulnerable with, one of these key methods for healing shame.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, it grows in secrecy, but shame melts away when it's shared in safe places.
Yeah. And a lot of people in those spaces, it takes a while for them to believe it and to let it in. Right.
Mm-hmm.
To really develop so-called shame resilience, you got to believe that you're worthy of the love, and at least some part of you. And if you can tap into and amplify that part of you, it's a great way to recover from being hobbled by shame.
Yeah.
And I find that psychedelic tools tend to be really powerful in this regard. You know, I think it's one of the reasons why MDMA assisted therapy, the data are so good on the outcomes, is mm-hmm. because of this flood of, you know, oxytocin, dopamine, all this fun neurochemical soup that just makes you feel open to yourself and to others. And it recontextualizes what was mm-hmm. once shameful. I mean, there's a reason why in the ceremony space, they call them heart openers, right? That stimulant medicines like MDMA open the heart.
Yeah, it's a reason why Rick Doblin, in his wisdom decades ago, chose MDMA as the first one to pursue mm-hmm. in the drug development focus of MAPS back then. And it's also interesting to look at the Stan Grof quote we talk about, how, you know, psychedelics are to the mind like the telescope is to astronomers. And what we might learn from bringing psychedelics back into, you know, back into use, and instead of being so outlawed, is because we're learning a lot about shame and healing from trauma through the MDMA work big time.
Yeah. Yeah. For somebody who's beset by toxic shame there, if there is any self-respect in there, it might be microscopic. So mm-hmm. we need a tool like psychedelics akin to the telescope or the microscope, to take a look at it.
Yeah. And to just show us the way in general, mm-hmm. like we're seeing these striking results, and not everyone will be able to access that, but at least anytime soon. It's going to take some time. There are cost barriers and other barriers to access, but we're also seeing, you know, what can happen with this kind of inner-directed approach, and as someone gets a good dose of self-love mm-hmm. and pro-social connection.
Yeah, it's why the container matters too. Of course, we've talked about it ad nauseum, set and setting. But when you do a powerful psychedelic medicine in a loving, secure, supportive, safe container, I think you increase the likelihood that it's going to be a way shower to those sensitive and self-loving places. We just talked about MDMA. I've found that psilocybin too often escorts people right through their bullshit narrative to mm-hmm. the truth of who they are. And I had a client once who had a psilocybin experience who had just really struggled with their inner critic, with their judge, thinking that they needed this self-flagellation to keep them motivated, but it was doing quite the opposite. And in spite of all of our good work, was just really having a hard time connecting to that idea. And one psilocybin, not to overstate this, but for him, it was one psilocybin experience. And he was like, oh yeah, I don't believe that stuff anymore. Like mm-hmm. I was just thinking too much. I was too attached to my thoughts. And you know, those voices certainly came back in integration, but he had this touchstone now that he could walk his way back to.
A crack in the facade.
Yeah.
That
the light show through.
Yeah. And you can follow that and work mm-hmm. with that and peel it open more,
mm-hmm.
practice it, integrate it.
Yeah. I think another good tool is gratitude. Hard to let an episode go by without talking about mm-hmm. the power of gratitude. But if you're having a hard time thinking good thoughts about yourself, conjuring up reasons why you might be worthy of love, then pivot to gratitude. And mm-hmm. if you can also feel gratitude for all of the many parts that constitute your psyche, feel gratitude for the things that maybe have been praised once or twice by others in your life, then that also might be a foot in the door.
Yeah. And then as that grows within you, you can start to, you know, extend it to the difficult things, to the hard lessons, you know, that time when you felt all this shame, but you figured out a way out of it mm-hmm. or that it was maladaptive for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Self-compassion, another tool. Yeah. Again, if you think you're a pile of garbage, it's hard to have compassion for that pile of garbage. But I was sitting with a client earlier this week, actually, and we did a little internal parts, inner child work, and traced back a feeling of being unloved and unworthy to an early childhood memory of his birthday being forgotten.
Mm.
And so, you know, like we do in these kinds of exercises, just had him imagine bringing his adult self into the room with his child self and giving that child self everything that he actually deserved but didn't get. And it was just mind-blowing for this client. Like, oh, maybe this is why I feel about myself, or this is at least part of the puzzle.
Light bulb moment.
And to have that experience of, well, I wouldn't say to a 7-year-old the things I say to myself as an adult. So one of the challenges I gave him was, when you notice that you're having self-critical thoughts, see if you can meet it at the threshold of consciousness and imagine, would I say this to my 7-year-old self? In, you know,
hell no.
in his bed, yeah, crying because everybody forgot his birthday. Of course not.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the lens through which he's going to look at his self-critical thoughts to see if he can, you know, make some changes.
Yeah. That's a great example of, you know, the process, right? How to begin the work. You know, you have this awareness, this moment of awakening, if you will, and then you can start to watch for it. You can start to reshape your patterns, including your relationship with vulnerability, your mm-hmm. shame, and all that.
Yeah, it's also a mindfulness tool, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a sort of tactical, practical way of cultivating mindfulness, meaning cultivating a new relationship to the nature of thought.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to, instead of being fused with thought, we're going to try to defuse from thought and believe the truth that just because a thought enters our mind doesn't mean we have to believe it. Yeah. Right? You are not your thoughts, as the saying goes.
Yeah, it's a good point, because mindfulness by definition is supposed to be non-judgmental awareness, right? Yeah, non-shaming.
Non-shaming awareness, right? You expand the boundaries of what is acceptable to infinite, to an infinite extent.
Yeah.
And that's tough. That's tough to do. Certainly, yeah, if I'm having a thought or I've done a thing that I would normally self-reject for. But then you just expand it to that. Right. And not that this needs to be a masterclass on mindfulness, but, you know, you can take a step back and say, oh, I'm having the thought that I shouldn't accept this. And that makes me feel disgust. Oh, I'm noticing disgust. I'm yeah. noticing that I have this urge to stop doing this exercise because I don't feel like I deserve it. Like everything that emerges into consciousness can be observed and non-judgmentally.
Yeah. And the potential rewards are huge there. And also some of the really big struggles that we could avert. Like I'm thinking of when you were talking about group therapy, just the value of being seen, being vulnerable and being seen. Mm. Like when one is experiencing hopelessness, which we see all too often, and it's such a difficult thing to experience, is made up of these two big components of like, no one knows how I feel, you know, I'm alone in this, and things are never going to get better. But through this connection, vulnerability, and getting to the other side of that shame that can be not only debilitating, but dangerous for mm-hmm. people, and self-harm and all that, you know, when you have that sense of like, oh, I'm not alone in it, it takes a big chunk of your hopelessness immediately and melts it away.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man. Being seen is so incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think it's becoming tragically more rare in society as we isolate ourselves and we judge ourselves against these impossible standards that we were referring to earlier. But man, there is nothing like being seen by somebody you want to be seen by. And when we say seen, we mean like, I see you. I see all your mm-hmm. flaws. In fact, I was getting a little sappy with my wife because it's Valentine's Day today. And mm-hmm. one of the things I told her I really appreciate about her is that she knows everything about me and she's still around.
Yeah.
She hasn't left me yet.
She deserves a medal.
Oh, at least a medal.
Yeah. But that is beautiful. It is so beautiful. Like you're saying, one of the core needs to be seen, heard, mm-hmm. understood, celebrated, even
celebrated, right? Regarded, accepted, not rejected.
Yeah.
I think I used the phrase earlier today or earlier in the, in the conversation, but, I feel like one of the secrets to a healthy relationship is, you know, related to shame, is giving each other the benefit of the doubt.
Oh yeah.
And that's threatening if, you know, you've tried to do that and this person is, it hasn't paid off. Right. And they've harmed you and they've betrayed you and there hasn't been trust, but, or safety, but, man, it's certainly paid off in the lives of my clients whom I've tried to coach into that space where they can start giving each other the benefit of the doubt. Certainly well supported by the Gottmans in their thorough research on what makes love last or dwindle.
Yeah, no, I love that. And yeah, it's one of my favorite tips for in like couples work is just to be generous in your interpretation of the other's behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, even if, because in the end, our assumptions are very often not accurate. And, you know, we have no idea, at least reflexively at first, what's going on inside the other's world, mm-hmm. That we might be jumping to conclusions about.
Yeah. I think another way to address shame is setting boundaries. A lot of times when we are, ashamed or when we have these really negative beliefs about ourselves, our boundaries are fairly porous and we'll just sort of let people do whatever they want to us and then feel upset about it. So it's a sign of self-respect and self-love to say no, to say yes to the things you want to say yes to. And that can be very uncomfortable. And then you do all the things to go in and through that emotion, but
that's empowering. Yeah.
Super empowering. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of my clients who, say yes to everything and have a hard time with setting boundaries, we just start with something small, but once they work through the discomfort around setting boundaries, they discover the life opens up quite a bit. And mm-hmm. it also communicates to others the way that you ought to be treated, and the ones that actually care about you versus the ones that you don't will be sorted out quickly.
Yeah. And it also models, like, and I'm not just talking about in parent-child relationships, but in groups of friends and communities, like, you know, how one can show up lovingly with boundaries still, mm-hmm. with saying no. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lovingly. Yeah, lovingly with boundaries. Well, any other thoughts, Reid, on shame, on ways to address shame, healing from it, developing shame resilience? You want to shame me for any reason? Now's your chance.
Fun.
How's that for an invitation?
I can't believe I'm passing on this invitation, but...
you'll do it later, I'm sure.
Do you remember... It just reminds me because I said passing, but, and I think, apologies if I've told this story before, but we were sitting in an ayahuasca circle, a rather big one, mm-hmm. in a far off land at a retreat once upon a time. And, you know, I'd consumed a healthy dose and it was still alive and well in me at the time of sharing time. And, it comes over to me to share something about the experience. And I just said, pass. Mm-hmm. And like so many people just turn and be like, did he just pass? Can you do that? I didn't know you could do that.
Nobody just passed.
But I felt good and empowered in that moment. I mean, there might've been a little bit of shame to work with mm-hmm. in the moment leading up to that. But it felt good to be able to do to listen to myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, in spite of any perceived social consequences, right? Perceptions based on your particular relationship to doing such a thing, but also what was happening here and now in that moment, right? To the extent that you could perceive it, people turning and being like, oh, is Reid okay? Mm-hmm. Is it okay to pass? I think we were told we could, which is why you did.
No one else needed to. Yeah, well, or felt they could.
Nobody else drank a metric ton of ayahuasca that night.
But another little shame success story on my journey. I'm working on it.
We all are. We are all a work in progress. So why don't we leave it there?
Thanks, Steve.
It's okay to be a work in progress.
Yeah. It's lovely chatting with you.
As always. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel. Like the videos and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.